Thanks for being with us, everyone, tonight. We're in a UFO roundtable with my guests, Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Joneas of Open Minds Productions. When we come back, I want to go around the world and see what the UFO scene is in a couple of places that you don't always hear about. China, Africa, for example. And I'd like to ask my guests about a theory proposed last month by my guest, Colonel John Alexander, that disclosure has already happened, that there is no active UFO cover-up within the U.S. government anymore. We'll get into that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. My guests both work for something called Open Minds Production, which has sort of become an unofficial clearinghouse for UFO information, at least in the United States. Alejandro, you were with MUFON for a long time. Tell me how this organization you're working for now differs and what it is exactly you guys are up to.
Really, with MUFON, it was a collection of data. And then my job alone, really, while I was doing as a director of education and also doing the PR for MUFON, was to try to get the word out, so which was, of course, a big job for one person. But especially doing it part-time or at least on my time off. Luckily here, it's more of a journalistic organization where we have a magazine, Open Minds Magazine, that's at all of the major bookstores where we write news stories. And really, they're straight news. They're not opinion pieces or feature pieces. They're getting the information and the facts and the news out to the people so they can make up their own opinion as opposed to listening to ours. And then we do the same thing on the website, except for here we keep on top of all the daily headlines on the website as well. We have a radio show with interviews, and then we do a lot of videos on YouTube. We have an incredible video production guy who does some great videos. And then we also do the UFO Congress. We acquired that, and that's the largest UFO event in the United States here, and that's gone great. We just held our very first one just a few weeks ago, last February, and it was the biggest ever. It was great, and we had John Alexander among many others there.
Antonio, of course, the difficulty, an organization like yours, you probably get a lot of UFO reports that come streaming in or strange stories. The problem, as always, is weeding out the bad ones, figuring out which ones are real and which ones deserve to be investigated. Do you have resources enough to do boots on the ground type investigation, or is it more of a collection of raw data?
Well, at this point, really, you know, it takes a lot of resources, especially if you're going to travel abroad. So we are doing what we can. Fortunately, you know, the communications technology these days, you know, allows you to be in touch with people all over the world and all that. So you can still follow a lot of stuff. But, you know, it would be exciting. But also we don't have a very big staff. So if we start sending, you know, half of the staff to cover things that are happening all over the place, we are not yet at that stage. But we hope that we will. We are, though, a unique company in the sense that I don't think there's any other company in the world like us. We are basically a UFO media company. We're very different from Bigelow or Rockefeller. You know, there were rich people in the past who mostly sponsored research, but that was it. They would do research, and then maybe some of it would eventually be published. But we are a media organization. We're constantly, you know, we have updates on our website every single day. And, of course, we publish this wonderful magazine. And, well, Alejandro just went through the list. So we
are you able to break even? I'm not asking you to open your books or anything. I know it's a struggle for magazines and all media right now. At least you hope to be able to.
Yeah, that's our goal. Eventually, that's our goal. But actually, the magazine is doing very well. And on the next issue, we have already the seventh issue is already out right now on the newsstands and on the bookstores. But on the next issue, we're going to increase our circulation dramatically. And this is based on what the distributors tell us. So we've actually done very well. But as you know, we're a new company, so it takes time to get established.
I just sent you a check for my subscription, so there's one more at least.
That's great, George. And, and people should check our website. You know, I don't know if I forgot to mention that all this stuff that we were discussing about the British documents and the UN, we posted. We just posted on Friday a big story, which I did, and people can download. There's a link directly to that particular dossier that brings those documents about the UN. So if people go to our website, openminds.tv, and they can download those documents directly.
And I know you both have sort of touched on this about the importance of the internet, the World Wide Web. It's meant so much to the UFO field. I mean, there's a whole lot of junk and garbage, of course, as there has always been associated with the field. But it really does allow researchers around the world to stay in touch and share information.
It's fantastic. I mean, I'm old enough in the field. You know, we were just talking at the beginning that it was so different back in the days when I started it. Everything had to be done by mail. By actually postage mail, you know, and when you wrote to countries in Eastern Europe or Asia, it would take weeks sometimes to get an answer. And or you could do it by phone. By phone was very expensive back in those days. There was nothing like Skype, all these things. And back in those days, you only had AT&T, and that was it. The fees for international overseas calls were huge. So most people couldn't do that. It had to be done by mail.
It's great right now because on a regular basis we're communicating with our associates in Turkey and in Mexico and in Hong Kong and all over the world, Brazil. So on a regular basis we're able to do that and get up to speed and interview some people firsthand who are dealing with some of these cases.
Let's talk about disclosure. Of course, that has been the topic in the UFO field for the last couple of years, people demanding that the government open its files and show us the secret energy technology and all this kind of stuff. We had Colonel Alexander on the program, and then he spoke at your UFO Congress. The theory espoused in his new book, basically that disclosures happen, that when the U.S. government dumped its documents after Blue Book, that was pretty much it, that there is no central organization that collects the information, that there is no central organization in charge of a cover-up. Let's start with you, Alejandro, your reaction to that general theme.
Yeah, I think that it's funny how heated that debate gets, too. Alexander was not a popular person at our conference.
I'll bet.
People get so upset with that message. But I really think he has something. Maybe they don't have all the answers that we think they have. A lot of people think that they're so far beyond, they have it all figured out. You know, it's like the Stargate TV show, and they're communicating with aliens and all over the universe and everything. That might not be the case, but I do think there's more to it than he believes. For instance, when we talk about Bentwaters and Rendlesham, there's a clear case of OSI agents coming in and talking to debriefing these guys. What information do they have? Where did that go? That went to somebody and some organization. Or when you talk to Gordon Cooper, and the UFO sighting that he had where his guys were able to film a UFO come and land, what, Nellis Air Force, or was it? Edwards Air Force Base. It landed on the dry lake bed. They were able to film this thing. He was told to hold on to the film. It was couriered off. We have multiple stories, regular stories like this coming where these unknown people come and collect that information and take it, and nobody hears from it again. There's a lot of information out there. Our next issue for the June-July is focused on Roswell, so we've been really focused on writing stories. I just interviewed Don Schmidt yet again the other day, and the abundance of witnesses and deathbed confessions are extraordinary, even to the evidence that there was a alien body. I mean, there are so many confessions and deathbed confessions, it's hard to disregard that. So who has that information? Somebody's got that information, and I doubt it's just kind of just willy-nilly out there. I think there's more to it than Alexander says, although maybe they don't have all the answers. On the other hand, though, I do kind of agree that a disclosure has happened, in that with the Disclosure Project, they went out to the press. I think it's out there to the public that there is reality to this phenomena. And anybody that takes a serious look at it can see that. And I think now, you know, if conventional media isn't going to get that information to the public, that's what I feel great doing. That's something that you all at Coast to Coast have been doing for so long. And you in particular have, you know, you broke the Area 51 story. So I think it's been amongst us people who call ourselves journalists who, or the public to then get this information out to the people.
Antonio, you recall something called the Bolander memo, which at the end of Blue Book, when it was canceled, there was a memo that came out from this Air Force guy, Bolander, who said, look, all the UFO reports which affect national security will continue to go where they've always gone. It doesn't say where it was. I asked John Alexander that, and he was pretty noncommittal in his answer. I don't think he knows where it would go. Do you have a theory about where it goes?
Yeah, I remember the Bolander memo because it's very, very important. Bolander was a general, right? Was an Air Force general, and that made it clear that the, let's say, the good cases were never even part of Blue Book. Blue Book, of course, for those listeners that may not be aware, I'm sure most of them are, was this Air Force, official Air Force investigation. And it was not secret because their budget was approved by Congress, and there were even congressional hearings about it. But even in the rumor mill, going all the way back to the 50s, you'll find it on the books by Major Kehoe and others, it's pretty clear that even back then, a lot of the good cases sometimes would go to Blue Book and then they would disappear from Blue Book. So Blue Book was sort of the first filter. And but eventually it became such of a PR nuisance for the Air Force because, you know, especially after that slum gas episode with Dr. Hynek in 1966, the Air Force got such bad publicity that eventually, and they used the Condon report to do it, you know, eventually they bailed out. But that was their public face. So it's obvious that there's something going on, but nobody's ever been able to really pin it down. Of course, Alexander, whom I've known for a number of years, had a group which was nicknamed the UFO Study Group, though these guys were, and that's when they were, Alexander and others were all part of the military or various intelligence or scientific agencies of the U.S. government. And it was sort of an informal group, but they knew already about the FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act, so they, in all their whatever correspondence they had, they never used the word UFO. It was called, I think, like the Advanced Physics Study Group or something like that, and that was specifically designed so if people did FOIA requests with the word UFO, that wouldn't show up. And now they claim, at least this is his story, that they were going to stumble sooner or later with some kind of black project that was dealing with this. But that never happened, according to him. They never could discover anything. Yet he himself told me an interesting story that often, he was specifically referring to one time where they went to a meeting, I think it was with an admiral, and they were trying to find out, right, is there the Navy, has the Navy any kind of UFO project or whatever? And the answer was no, we don't deal with this. And then when the meeting was over, this admiral went to Alexander and told him on his ear, but let me tell you about my UFO sighting.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of that.
Now, there's an interesting proposal that actually Alexander makes, which we will publish in the forthcoming issue of Open Minds, which is, I believe, the last chapter of his book, where he says that even though he believes that disclosure already has happened, but he admits that there are still many reports, I mean cases, incident, witness cases that happened to people while they were on the service. And he's recommending that their oath of secrecy should be lifted. And I think that's a great proposal.
Don't you think that disclosure, and a lot of people are clamoring for it, I'm not sure that everyone or even anyone in the UFO field will ever be satisfied no matter what form disclosure took. Anything short of the president coming out and said, yes, we've got aliens and we've got alien bodies and we've got flying saucers and we're reverse engineering them and we're keeping it all secret. Now leave us alone. I mean, it's never going to happen and it's never going to satisfy people if it did happen, don't you think?
You are absolutely right. I think that a lot of people in the UFO community, they'll never accept it unless that circumstance happened. And I don't think that'll ever happen unless it was such a dramatic incident itself that would sort of the UFO situation force the issue. But otherwise, I think that we will see more of the same. It's not that there will be the big announcement. It's sort of a death by a thousand cuts. You know, it's not not like there will be the big announcement, but it's slowly, a little account here, some government releases some documents there, some other government opens a UFO agency. There's a meeting on UFOs at an important conference in Saudi Arabia. The Vatican makes announcements, and we're living this practically on a weekly basis. There's some kind of announcement, meeting, some important organization, the Royal Society, whoever, you know, that is. So it's slowly, the public and the public perception is definitely changing.
And Alejandro.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and how can we trust the government, especially the defense industry, when we hear about scandal after scandal after scandal? I think we've definitely become a very cynical society when it comes to that, which I think when we had these scandals during the Rumsfeld years with budgets and everything like that, that helps this field, because then people were more open to, okay, maybe we are being lied to by defense, and maybe they do hide things. How could you trust anything they said? I think what if disclosure were to happen, even my assumption, not even trying to be conspiratorial, but and maybe it's a little bit cynical, is that you can't trust that they're going to give us a whole story or even an accurate story.
Well, I agree with something Whitley Strieber said a long time ago, and I think he even wrote about it in Communion, that the true architects of the secrecy are the visitors, whoever they are. I know you as an organization, you don't take a position on whether they're aliens or interdimensionals or angels or whatever, but, you know, they have, these things appear when they want to appear. They allow themselves to be seen here and there, sometimes on radar, sometimes not, sometimes visually, sometimes not. It's like they call the shots, they decide. Obviously, they haven't landed on the White House lawn. They're the ones that that call the shots on the whole secrecy thing to begin with.
Yeah, Nick Pope says this field is definitely an events-led field, and I agree with him completely. Really, the big stories are typically ones where a big sighting has happened. O'Hare, Stephenville, you know, these big things that happen are events. They're a UFO event that creates this big media buzz.
Yeah, and I agree with that statement by Strieber. I mean, it's obvious that if the UFO people, you know, the visitors, whatever they are, extraterrestrials, interdimensional, like officially, like you say, and we don't have an official position in an organization, but I personally believe after being so many decades, that is a multiplicity. I mean, we're probably dealing with extraterrestrial and dimensional beings and from many places, and that's why you see such a difference, too, in the reports and also even in the intentions. You see some cases that are benign, other cases are not so good for the witnesses, and so on. But especially when it comes to this whole issue of abductions, it is clear that the aliens themselves, they are the architects of the secrecy. I mean, if they wanted the secrecy over, it could have been done any time. You know, all they would have to do is, there's the proverbial landing on the White House, but even more significant probably would be to, if you just parked a huge UFO over CNN headquarters or something like that, you know, and stay there for 45 minutes. So the whole world will film you and whatever. They haven't done that. Yes, they do appear over Mexico City, you know, over Phoenix. Of course, we had the Phoenix lights over other cities, but it's always, there's an ambiguity. You know, they appear, they're seen, they're photographed, they're filmed, but that's it. Then they moved on. So there's always sort of a deniability in the way they even appear. So I don't know. It's whatever they're doing, they don't seem to want to do it in a full public manner.
It seems like a learning curve, like it's giving us a little crumb here and there, you know, dropping a crumb to lead us down a path. So we learn it in little tiny bits and pieces. And if you know, we don't know if they're visitors from other planets or other dimensions or all of the above. It just suggests that the world around us, the universe that we know, reality itself, is far more wondrous, far larger and more mysterious than we can imagine.
Yeah,
exactly.
Absolutely right.
We're going to take a break here coming up in a moment. I want to talk about a couple of other countries around the world. A lot of activity in China. I want to talk about Africa, if you're getting any reports from there. Go back to Japan. We touched on it briefly in relation to the tsunami, but I want to go back to Japan because you would think with all the cameras and electronic gear that the Japanese have that we'd be getting a lot of UFO reports out of that part of the world. And then you also mentioned Mexico, and I know you guys have a relationship with Jaime Musan, who's come up with some incredible videos over the year. want to get your take on the quality and credibility of that information. Stay with us. Our conversation with Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Hineas of Open Minds Productions continues. I'm George Knapp, and this is Coast to Coast AM. We're talking with Alejandro Rojas and Antonio Hineas of Open Minds Production about UFO activity around the world, reports coming in from all over the place. We'll continue the conversation and then open up the phone lines at the top of the hour right here on Coast to Coast AM. Alejandro, let's go back to Japan. We touched on it briefly in association with the tsunami and the earthquake, but I wondered if you could tell me whether or not you get a level of activity or reports coming out of that part of the world, because as I mentioned going into the break, so many Japanese have cameras and cell phones and electronic gear. You would think there'd be, if there's a level of activity, we'd see a lot more video and photos.
Well, the hard part is we don't get a lot of news from other countries, and it's really difficult. I wish we had, you know, that's something that I think in ufology we need to work on. And like you were able to make some connections in Russia. But it's difficult to, we don't have any, like, organization in Japan that we're all talking to get this information. And it looks like the Japanese government's open to this. I mean, it made big news recently when the prime minister's wife talked about believing in aliens and believing she communicated with aliens. Also, actually, in the WikiLeaks, one of the UFO comments in the WikiLeaks was just a story that was going around in the embassies in 2007 when the chief cabinet secretary in Japan was upset that the Air Force said they didn't believe in UFOs. And he said, well, UFOs have to be real. And in other words, how would you explain the Nazca lines otherwise? And so he was another government official open to the whole idea. And culturally, I mean, I watch some anime, some of the Japanese shows and stuff, and you see they're always wearing UFO T-shirts and talking about Roswell, and it culturally UFOs is a big deal out there. But unfortunately, I don't know any researchers or know many researchers who know other Japanese researchers to get an idea of how many sightings are happening and what are the big sightings that are happening.
Is there a Japanese MUFON?
No, I mean, really, MUFON has not been able to create a Japanese chapter.
Antonio, talk to me about China, because we do see a lot of reports, at least on the internet. I don't know how reliable they are, UFO information coming out of China. And I've been told that there are UFO organizations that have as many as 100,000 people. It seemed like that would be an area that would be ripe for picking for UFO researchers.
Right. Yeah, there's a big difference between China and Japan. Japan, by the way, I want to mention it just briefly because I've been in Japan. I actually worked in some projects in the 90s. I was there three times, and one time I actually stayed for about a month in Tokyo when I was in the middle of, we were producing this CD-ROM back then in the 90s. But yes, the problem in Japan, even though the culture is very open to it, like Alejandro said, but there is no national UFO organization. There are small groups, regional groups, but they tend to be very small, sort of the same pattern that we see in a lot of the South American countries where you don't see, with the exception of Brazil. Brazil has the CPDV, you know, similar to MUFON, run by HHA, but the other countries have a lot of small clubs. But China, now, that's a different story. In China, we have, and actually, what I would call it a semi-official organization. It's known in the English acronym as CURO, China UFO Research Organization. And this was started around the late 70s, when China first opened up, you know, to the West under Deng Xiaoping, back after the fall of the Gang of Four and all that upheaval, you know, following the death of Chairman Mao. Prior to that, there was absolutely no structure whatsoever to report or to communicate to the populace about the existence of UFOs. So much so that when CURO was created, they got thousands of letters from people who said, yes, when I was in the service, I was in Inner Mongolia and a UFO landed and whatever, you know, I was in such and such a city. But back in those days, China was so isolated from the rest of the world we're talking, you know, the earlier period of Chairman Mao, the 50s and 60s and up to the mid-70s, that people were not aware that the rest of the world was experiencing this phenomenon known as UFOs or flying saucers. The Russians knew about it because in Russia, yes, there was some talk about it, even in the days of censorship, but not in China. So when people saw these machines or these craft, they didn't know that this was a worldwide phenomenon, and they assumed that they had to be either American or Soviet. That was back then. Once Kuro was created, and like I said, it's not a totally official agency, but it was part of a group of researchers from the University of Wuhan who were also part of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences. So it had the backing of the Chinese Communist Party. And in fact, the first president of Kuro, whom I personally know, you probably met him too, George, if possible, Sun Shili, Professor Sun Shili.
No, I haven't met him.
Okay, because he was probably at one of the UFO congresses years ago, but this man he speaks perfect Spanish, and that's how I was able to interview him years ago. What happened? He's an economist. He's a professor of economics at Beijing University, where he's getting old now, and he was the official interpreter for Spanish for Chairman Mao. So this guy got around. And in fact, I have a picture that he gave me where he's very young at the time, and it shows him, Chairman Mao, and the president of the Uruguayan Communist Party. So whenever some dignitary from either Latin America or Spain would visit China, he was the interpreter. So he's a man, you know, with some pretty serious credentials. And I don't know what's the current membership. At one time, it was something like 30 or 40,000, but which already would make it the biggest UFO organization in the world, much larger than MUFON. But of course, for China, 40,000 people, and so that was years ago. It's very likely that it is 100,000 now. But for China, you're talking still a relatively small organization, you know, because it's got such a huge population. But yes, so in China, you do have a nationwide system that does report on UFOs, which is...
Any indication of Chinese government studies or military files?
Well, these people are connected to the government. Like I said, they're a semi-official, so they're not like a totally official commission, but they do. And in fact, Sun Shili told me that one of the things they were trying to work on was, or one of the things that they were interested in was to see if they could get some insights into the propulsion that these objects use, and so, which is very similar, I believe, to some of the ideas that Bob Bigelow had. So if they could get some actual practical result out of it. And there was a guy, and I have it somewhere in my files, I don't have it in front of me, but there was a guy who had come up with some kind of propulsion theory that could be adapted, let's say, to our needs, and they had even made a presentation to the People's Army. So these people do work for government organizations and are connected, but it is sort of like a semi-official. It's an interface with the public.
What about Africa? I don't know which of you wants to tackle this question or both, but there was a lady named Hind.
Yes, I knew her.
She used to come up to MUFON and make reports every couple of years about activity on the African continent. I just haven't heard anything from Africa in a long time.
Yeah, well, Africa, you have to understand that... I don't believe there's any government cover up in Africa. I mean, a lot of those countries are poor, and they have a host of other much more immediate problems that they have to deal with. So that's the reason. Yeah, normally you don't hear much about Africa, but there was the fantastic, very famous case which we covered in the first issue of Open Minds magazine, which was the landing at the Ariel School. I'm sure you heard about this case,
yes.
George.
Yeah.
It happened, I believe, it was in 1994, and it was seen by dozens and maybe as far as 60 or 70 of the children, who of course are grown up now. And there's a filmmaker called Randall Nickerson, and he actually reopened this case. This case had been investigated back then, first by Cynthia Hine and then by the late Professor John Mack of Harvard. He went there and interviewed the witnesses and did quite a thorough investigation. He was totally convinced that this case was for real. It was basically basically a landing. This was a case where the UFO landed, and these entities came out of the UFO, and some of the children that were even the closest to the UFO had some kind of, for lack of a better word, you know, some kind of psychic communication or something. They did get some kind of message. And it was a very significant case. Now, what Nickerson find out as a result of the interview I did with him, several months ago now, is that it was actually much bigger than what people had thought. Once he got there, of course, he couldn't do much firsthand research in Zimbabwe itself, because Zimbabwe, as you know, with the Mugabe government, is a basket case. But it turned out that most of the students had actually emigrated to South Africa, mostly because of probably economic reasons. So he did a lot of lectures and radio interviews and put the word out that there was a filmmaker from the United States, you know, looking for witnesses of this incident and so on. And he actually was able to locate dozens of them, and he interviewed them. And that's how he found out that they had been it was actually a wave. It was not just that one incident. It was a series of incidents that happened over a period of about 2-3 days. So that's the most famous case. But South Africa, also, because South Africa being a richer country, they did have UFO investigation groups. So there is quite a rich history of UFOs in South Africa. As you get further to the other countries, it's spotty. But if you look hard enough, you'll find some.
Go ahead, Alejandro.
In an update, I just got a text from Ruben Uriarte, who is actually the international liaison for MUFON. And he did say they do have 6 members in Japan now.
Oh, well, yeah. No, they had members. I'm sure they had some members. And probably at one time there was even a UFO, a MUFON representative. But also you have the problem of language. So when you're dealing with China, Japan, or some of the African countries, even if they have a UFO group and they do collect cases, you know, they're going to be in Chinese and Japanese, or maybe they'll try to write to you in English, or they'll put it through a Google translator or something, but still, you know, it's going to be garbled. So that's also a problem. For me, I do okay with a lot of foreign languages, but still it's mostly French, Spanish, Portuguese, Italian, you know, the Latin languages I can deal with. But unfortunately, I do not know Japanese or Chinese or Russian or some of the other languages.
You both have been around the UFO scene long enough to know that infighting, backbiting, internecine warfare, eating your young, at least in American ufology, it sort of characterizes the field. It's a lot of nastiness and bitterness. And the first thing you know, this organization or that organization implodes on itself. I'm leading up to the discussion about MUFON. Alejandro, you worked with MUFON for a long time. You were a spokesperson for the organization. Of late, it's been a pretty nasty scene. I don't want to put you too much on the spot because I know you know some of the personalities involved, but the former director has basically attacked the current board, and all kinds of implications made that they've made a deal with the devil, specifically Bob Bigelow, and it's caused a lot of problems, I think, for MUFON. Any reflections on that from you?
Yeah, I don't mind speaking to it because I did have some insight. I was a functional director during the time of the whole Bigelow thing when it started, and I honestly saw some PR difficulties knowing how people are so conspiratorial in this field that might have or that might arise. And sure enough, they did. But I know it would be James, the director at the time, who would bring some of the stuff up. Not that they're bad things. I think people have to understand, you know, I think that, you know, Bigelow, you've worked with him. He's someone who's interested, genuinely interested in this field. And unfortunately, like you said, you know, the conspiracies come up, the backbiting comes up, and everybody, all of a sudden, anybody with any type of influence, our boss, the guy who funds us, you know, there's suspect now people are saying, oh, he's working for the government and blah, blah, blah. Maybe we all are with open minds. And it's unfortunate because then when these people come forward who want to do something in the field and help the field, they get attacked and then they don't want to work in the field anymore. With MUFON, you know, Clifford Clift, who's a new director, who was a business director during the time of the Bigelow arrangement, he even admits that, you know, there was communication issues between Bigelow and MUFON, and that there were some gray areas that weren't worked out where Bigelow had some expectations, MUFON had different expectations, and that maybe it wasn't the best fit, the first iteration of it, and they probably won't go into it, another agreement like that. I think that's just being honest. That's really what happened. These are all people who are genuinely trying to search for some truth, and MUFON being more about getting information out to the public. Once it's been investigated and people try to say there's some secrecy and Bigelow hid the information, no, the journal posted the best cases. I was in constant communication with the guy who was the lead researcher for MUFON, and he posted journal postings in the MUFON journal on the best cases they investigated with Bigelow. He also gave us information where we wrote these in our magazine. So that information is all out there, and there were some pretty good cases. That's it what happened. Unfortunately, James did not get along well with Bigelow and their people. He also then suspected something more was going on, and he was even suspecting that perhaps the MUFON board was being dishonest because he was hearing this from third-hand sources. But that's what's unfortunate. You hear a lot of things with third-hand sources. When you have a first-hand, like John Schussler, who's been in this field for a long time, who's also worked with Bigelow, when John Schussler clarifies something to you, you could either believe it or not. And if you don't believe that, how can you work with someone in a business aspect? And that trust just broke down with the board, and James had felt that he was done wrong, and he was very upset about it. But honestly, I think that from a third-party perspective, really having no stake, and being a friend of James, I mean, he's the one who got me that directorship with MUFON. I think the board did what they had to do. They made the best decisions they could at the time. Really, I don't see any fault with what they've done now or did then. They're trying to keep this organization going like they have for over 40 years. They've done an incredible job keeping MUFON alive for a long, long time. And that's their main concern, to keep these investigations happening. It's unfortunate James feels the way he does, but I wish everybody would just kind of move on with doing their research, doing what they can to help out this field instead of holding on to these grudges.
Well, we're in agreement on that. I mean, I know Bob Bigelow pretty well, so I'm a little bit biased on the point, but I know that his interest is genuine, that he wants to get to the bottom of it. He put up a bunch of money, and he wanted it spent on investigations. And it's unfortunate that it sort of degraded, and now that MUFON finds itself under attack, because I think, as you mentioned, everyone is interested in the same thing, and that's getting to the bottom of this mystery.
Yep.
Any thoughts on that, Antonio, before we shift gears?
I agree with that. I used to be part of MUFON too, but that was a while ago. But I wanted to just, and this is not a good news, but what you said at the beginning about all the infighting and the backbiting and all that, unfortunately, that's not just American ufology. That seems to be a universal. Some of the worst feuds that I ever saw were in Russia. And you may be familiar with some of these with Azhaja, way they were. Sure enough, in Azhaja, these two characters, they hate each other, and they slander each other on the web and in articles. In Chile too, they have lots of different groups. And, I'm sort of the big guy that is in the United States, and I used to go there and do big, and they would try to get me involved, you know, to take sides. So that was the problem for me. I always said, well, that's your problem. You know, I'm not going to take sides. I had good relations with everybody, all the different UFO groups there, so I try to stay out of it. I remember in Hungary, it seems to be universal. Probably some countries is less so than others, but I've seen it around. And also, it just makes it easier for the governments or those who want to keep this thing on the lid.
That's exactly right. I mean, I guess it just comes with the territory or something. Something about the subject brings this up. There is another organization, APRO, which no longer exists, but which is relevant in the work you guys are doing. I'll ask that question when we come back, and then we'll open up the phone lines. My guests, Alejandro Rojas, Antonio Janaez, whatever your UFO question is, they can come up with at least a tidbit or two of information. So get those questions ready. I'm George Knapp. This is Coast to Coast AM.